impeachment. The only thing that's changed now is that we're moving into an election year, and she's willing to pursue a partisan impeachment.
Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador says his government rejects Democratic lawmakers' plans to allow U.S. inspectors to check Mexican factories for labor law compliance.
Mexico wants the U.S. Congress to approve a new North American trade accord before U.S. elections next year complicate the picture. Democrats are concerned Mexico's unrepresentative unions have led to low wages that drain manufacturing jobs from the U.S. López Obrador noted Mexico had passed reforms requiring free and fair union elections in its factories and approved a budget for monitoring. He says some Democrats continue raising concerns about implementation and compliance and requested inspectors. Jeremy House reporting.
More on these stories at townhall.com.
Sebastian Gorka here for Relief Factor, the 100% drug-free supplement that was formulated by doctors to help your body deal with inflammation and pain. The reason I've told so many of my friends about the 3-week quick start is because as we get older, occasional aches and pains can be a real problem, keeping you from sleeping through the night or doing the things you love and need to do, like taking walks or playing golf, going up or downstairs, or simply playing with your kids or grandkids. Tens of thousands are now like me, glad they ordered the 3-week quick start for just $19.95. After years of back pain, I found relief, and I believe you could too. Folks, this is why the father and son owners of Relief Factor, Pete and Seth Talbot, created the 3-week quick start, and they discounted it to only $19.95. Approximately 70% of those who order it go on to order more. Let's see if we can get you out of pain too. Go to relieffactor.com, relieffactor.com, or call 800-500-8384.
United Airlines will replace some of its older Boeing planes with 50 new Airbus jets starting in 2024.
Chicago-based United has announced that it placed an order for Airbus A321 XLR jets, a long-range version of the European company's single-aisle A321neo. They will eventually replace United's 53 Boeing 757-200s. The decision is a setback for Boeing, which is also based in Chicago and is reeling from the grounding of its 737 MAX jets after 2 deadly crashes.
That is correspondent Jeremy House reporting. United Chief Commercial Officer Andrew Nocella says that the MAX doesn't have the range of the A321 XLR and that Boeing hasn't decided whether to build a new midsize plane. He says that United will use the Airbus jets mostly between the East Coast and Europe.
You're listening to K-Talk Radio, KBJA.
Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Hello, this is Bruce Webster with Chris Fredrickson, and I believe we have Mike Parker on the line. Mike, you on the line?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
We can hear you just fine. Okay, my headphones just stopped working. 60s in a minute. Welcome to the first hour of the Interpreter Radio Show, sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the scriptures, history, and doctrine of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, brought to you by Cruise Lady. tonight we're switching up the order here. We're first hour, we're going to do the Come Follow Me. Followed second hour with general topic discussion, and with this roundtable, we begin the Book of Mormon for 2020. So we have the first Come Follow Me lesson on the introductory pages of the Book of Mormon. Let's launch into this. let me start by offering my opinion, which I think is actually very defensible, that most secular naturalistic explanations for both the existence and coming forth and content of the Book of Mormon just pretty much fall on their faces. This is something I've been looking at for half a century, and the same old arguments go round and round, and frankly, they all fall apart pretty easily, which is my 2 cents worth. Mike and Chris, your thoughts.
Go ahead, Chris.
I come from the position as an author, and to be perfectly honest, when I put a manuscript together, it's a sometimes up to 6-year process. But one of the things I find myself doing, for me, the evidence is just in the way that it was written. I mean, here's something that, for all intents and purposes, was written in 90 days. It's written in a variety of different writing styles. Every author has a style. In fact, I took an English class at BYU where you wrote in the style of a certain author so that you could start to recognize their writing voice. And you see different styles in that. The other thing that's most intriguing to me is that when I work, and I haven't worked on something for a little while, or even if I just worked on it the day before, I generally will back up a little bit to get up to speed where I am and to get back into the flow of things. Joseph Smith and, you know, whoever was scribing for him at that time, this was written in 90 days. It's a very complicated text, cross-references itself a lot. There's a lot of the same doctrine that's woven in and out of all these different books in the Book of Mormon. But then the fact that he never went back and kind of came up to speed, but he started from where he left off, he moved forward, and there was no editing. I can promise you, on some of my chapters and some of my books, I've done upwards of 30 edits to those chapters. And so it's incomprehensible to me that this could be the work of one man. And then the way that he did it, he's working in the, you know, most of the time, I mean, he's certainly working in Pennsylvania, but he's also working at the Whitney Farm, and there are people coming in and out of that very small house, and so, yes, he's putting his face. I go in and I close my office door. He didn't have that luxury or that option, and so perhaps he's putting his face into that hat so that he can see his seer stone, or so that he can see the words, or so that that information is communicated to him, but also just to block out what else is going on around him. So to try to make the case that this is some kind of a forgery, or that it is something that's been lifted from other people's work and those other works that are often cited, it's absolutely ludicrous if you've read them.
Well, yeah, and actually I have read them. I have both View of the Hebrews by Ethan Smith and the Spalding manuscript. And it doesn't take very long to realize they bear little or no resemblance to the Book of Mormon. It's very interesting how often people will try to seize upon individual phrases or words and say, well, look, this phrase is used here and this phrase is also used there. Jeff Lindsay, on his excellent blog, Mormanity, did a great post, oh gosh, a couple of years ago, where it was a tongue-in-cheek satire that had Joseph and Emma Smith delving through all these various sources and picking a phrase from here and a phrase from there and just weaving them in, and of course, none of it explains the actual content of the Book of Mormon itself.
Nor how does Joseph Smith? Why are there so many similarities between ancient rites and practices in the Book of Mormon among those Book of Mormon people that you find in that ancient biblical world? There's no way Joseph Smith could have known those things.
So we have this issue, and again, this lesson for Come Follow Me is the introductory pages of the Book of Mormon. You basically have three things to talk about. One is the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. One is the testimony of the witnesses, and the third is the actual title page, introduction of the Book of Mormon itself from the text. We're talking right now about the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. Mike, thoughts and comments.
Just to echo what Bruce and Chris said, everything that we have by way of physical evidence or by testimony of people who are involved indicates that Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon exactly the way that we affirm that he did. If you look at the manuscripts of the Book of Mormon, and those are available on the Joseph Smith Papers website, josephsmithpapers.org. You see very clearly a manuscript that is dictated, not composed and edited or compiled. It is simply line after line after line of written text by the scribe, no punctuation, no corrections or editing, with the exception of a handful of times where it was clearly the scribe either misheard Joseph or misspelled something or made some type of error and had to go back and correct his own work. What we don't see are reworking and editing. And for those who are only familiar with writing during the time period of modern word processor, many of you are, many people are not old enough to remember as I am. I'm kind of that last generation before the word processor became sort of ubiquitous. I remember in high school back in the 1980s that I would type my papers on a typewriter. And if I made a mistake and if I saw something and said, oh, you know what, this paragraph actually looks a little bit better if I put it farther up on the page, I had to retype the entire page. You know, if I made a small mistake, maybe one or two letters, I could use some whiteout and fix that. But most of the time, if I really, really messed something up, I'd have to completely redo the entire manuscript. And we don't see any of that with the Book of Mormon. The manuscripts are just clean and pure and line after line after line. Now, Joseph Smith did do some editing to the text in 1837 for the second edition. He cleaned up some of the grammar a bit and changed some difficult words, you know, to change some, you know, these to use and so forth. And but it's all fairly minor stuff. You don't see any major changes in the Book of Mormon in that edit. There's only three passages, in fact, that anyone could even try to argue that there's some type of theological change going on. So, yeah, the Book of Mormon clearly came about in the way that Joseph Smith said it. It did. It just simply isn't possible for a book of that length and that complexity and that inspiration to see millions of people over the course of now nearly two centuries have found this book to be inspiring and meaningful in their lives. You know, if somebody were to just simply try to dictate something like that, it would come out to be gibberish. You know, there'd be a handful of good things here and there, but it's just page after page of good quality inspirational material, and there's simply no way it could have been done in any other way.
And it's a very complex document. It is not it is not Jonathan Livingston Siegel, to quote a book from my era. It is a very complex, very intricately structured document with shifts of viewpoint, shifts of authors, interweaving of various sources. And there's a great book called From Darkness Unto Light. I think it's Coming Forth of the Book of Mormon, From Darkness Unto Light, by, I don't know if he pronounces it, Mackey or McKay and Dirk Mott, that I would strongly recommend, because to echo what Mike said a few minutes ago, what is most telling is that as more and more historical sources are checked against each other and brought to bear, what you do find out is that the historical record, there's nothing to support any of the alternate explanations for the Book of Mormon. They all pretty much say, yeah, these people were here at this time, and this is what was happening, and this is where they were, and this is you know, as far as we have any documentation of it. That, of course, doesn't stop people from trying to come up with alternate explanations, but none of them really hold water. I mean, the one I think is currently most credible is some sort of automatic writing, and I use credible with quotes around that, is some sort of automatic writing. You know, somehow Joseph Smith was inspired to do all this. But even there, when they've gone to sources of other examples of automatic writing, you don't have something that has the quality of what the Book of Mormon has in terms of its the complexity of the narrative, the ties to ancient sources, and the inherent quality of the work. Chris?
I was just going to add, too, when we were talking about, you know, when it finally does go to press, it's completed June of 1829. They have to get financial backing. That's going to come from Martin Harris predominantly. Copyright June 11th, 1829. March 26th, 1830, the Book of Mormon goes on sale. What's really interesting to me, however, is that when the manuscript, or a copy of the manuscript, because they're being very protective because of what happened with the loss of the 116 pages, but when the copy of the original manuscript, and that's what mostly went to the printer and the typesetter, it was the typesetter that put in the punctuation. There wasn't punctuation in there, and that was nothing unusual in the 19th century. They certainly didn't have standardized as we do today. And so those emendations, a lot of the emendations that Joseph Smith does, are simply to kind of clean up where the typesetter put in maybe a period or a comma that didn't really belong there. I also know that in some later editions, they took out, I think, 70 and it came to passes, which I'm extremely grateful for. I wish they'd taken out more. But it's an extraordinary work, and you can tell. You know, we'll get into this in just a minute. We're going to talk a little bit about the witnesses, I think. And when we do, I have had for a long period of time, but included in this new, the Book of Mormon, Another Testament of Jesus Christ, the Maxwell Institute Study Edition, you have Emma Smith's testimony. And she describes her husband as basically an illiterate man. Not illiterate, he could read and he could write, but he was not a well-educated classically well-educated individual. And so for him to pull this off, first, someone with a college education, with a PhD, with whatever in writing, that would be one thing, would still be difficult for them. For Joseph Smith, it would have been virtually impossible on his own.
And we will get to the witnesses in the next segment, but I think for those of you who are listening to this to enrich your personal study and for family groups, it's worth taking the time to go through again Joseph Smith's own story if it's coming forth, which is included in the front of the Book of Mormon. Or you can go, as my wife and I actually just did this past few weeks ago, went through Joseph Smith history in A Pearl of Great Price to get the overall context. But the important point here is that you've got this incredible work has come forth, and it's hard to find anything equivalent to it. Again, a lot of critics say, well, this is the sort of thing that happened all the time in the 19th century. It's like, oh, yeah, show us the other one. Show us the equivalent of the Book of Mormon that was produced by anyone else of any level of education, much less, you know, a farm boy with 3 years of education. And Hugh Nibley in I think it was in Since Camorra, talked about the issue here, and he says it's like a farm boy finding a large diamond out in the field, and people say, well, no one could find a large diamond out in the field, or, you know, it's not really a large diamond because other people have found quartz out in the field. And he says, but people don't do what's obvious, which is test it and say, is this a diamond? And so we know the circumstances of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. We actually have a lot of historical evidence for that. And the question now is, what are we going to do to test that this is actually a diamond? And that's part of what we'll be getting into throughout the course of this year's Come Follow Me studies.
Well, let me add one thing, too. If you do want a comparative model for a book of this sort, since this is another testament of Jesus Christ, you can look at all of those different editions of the Bible. And they were working with what we would call primary source documents. They were working with older texts that they determined which to canonize and which not to canonize. And in some Bibles, you know, there are some things that are considered canonical and others that are not, and they're left out of other editions. But nevertheless, all of these were worked on by an enormous number of theologians and scholars over years and years period of time. If we want to, you know, compare to another testament of Jesus Christ, which would be those editions of the Bible.
Mike? Other thoughts?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, and you can follow this up with the revelations that Joseph Smith gave and are canonized in especially the ones that are canonized in the Doctrine and Covenants, which are also quite complex, but very different than what we find in the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon is a narrative. It's a coherent narrative, very tight and very focused. It switches back and forth from first person to third person, and it does so in a logical and orderly manner. If you compare that to Joseph's revelations, and I'm not trying to downplay Joseph's revelations, but they're just completely different types of documents entirely. And Joseph would dictate them most commonly to a scribe, his revelations, but they're not in any way like the Book of Mormon. It's fascinating to me to see that Joseph's first calling as a prophet was to translate an ancient work and publish it to the world, and then everything else that he does in his prophetic career, with the possible exception of maybe the Book of Abraham, is completely different than that. This is just, it's that anybody could say that he wrote this, or that any combination of individuals wrote this, is just flabbergasting. I can't, and I think the only reason why people do come up with these theories is because they can't come to grips with the very obvious problem that they have, that they can't say that Joseph Smith translated it the way that he said he did, because that would mean that Joseph Smith is a prophet, and there's a lot of things that entail or the follow from that.
Okay, and with that, we're going to go on a break now, and see you in a few minutes. And we're back with the Interpreter Radio Show. This is the Come Follow Me Roundtable for the introductory pages to the Book of Mormon. I'm Bruce Webster, here with Chris Fredrickson and Mike Parker, calling in from elsewhere. where exactly do you live, Mike?
I live in the area of St. George, Utah. Not in St. George, but in the surrounding community, where we do not have to shovel sunshine.
Now, there you go. Sunshine, shoveling sunshine. We're talking for this lesson. This is the very first Come Follow Me lesson on the Book of Mormon, which is on the introductory pages. And it is very interesting that something that has been with the Book of Mormon ever since its publication have been the statements of witnesses. And two very different statements, the statement of the three witnesses and the statement of the eight witnesses. Plus, as Chris mentioned, the Maxwell Institute's study version of the Book of Mormon, study edition, has the statement of Emma Smith as well. And there are other witnesses to various aspects of the translation of the Book of Mormon, the reality of the plates, so on. And that also is a very intriguing difference between the Book of Mormon and just about anything you will see that tries to claim some sort of authoritative or scriptural nature for it. We have what's very interesting is you have the statement of the three witnesses, which is testifying of a miraculous event, literally having an angel appear, showing them the plates, Sword of Laban, various other items, and testifying them. And then you have the statement of the eight witnesses, which is a very matter of fact, saying we all hefted the plates and saw them. There's nothing miraculous about it, other than the fact that they're testifying, yeah, there were plates. I find it interesting that you have some Book of Mormon critics who have tried to explain away the plates and then finally said, well, Joseph Smith made some tin plates, and that's, you know, and colored them gold or something. which actually is even less credible, because that would be a very expensive proposition. And what's very clear from Joseph Smith's history is that he and his family lacked funds. So the idea of trying to make 60 pounds of gold plates is pretty ridiculous. So what's most interesting is the Interpreter Foundation, this is the Interpreter Foundation radio show, has raised the funds and is putting together a movie specifically about all the different witnesses to the Book of Mormon, to the reality of the plates, to the translation process, and so on. I think they have finished principal filming. I think they are into post-production and editing at that point. I don't know offhand what the anticipated release date is, but if you go to witnessesfilm.com, witnessesfilm is all one word, and that's witnesses plural, witnessesfilm.com, you can find information, you can see screenshots from the film itself, and a description of the anticipated distribution, and so on and so forth. So here we are with actual witnesses to the plates, actual witnesses to the reality of the angel and the other Book of Mormon artifacts. And we have the Lord in essence saying, okay, you know, you can try to argue about other things, but now you have to explain away the witnesses as well. People have tried mightily for coming up on 190 years to explain away this witness statements, and no one has ever done it successfully. Usually they do it by taking occasional phrases or descriptions out of context by individual witnesses and then ignoring what has been said by those same witnesses on other occasions or the entire context of what they have. Chris, do you have some thoughts?
I'll just speak to the idea, to this idea of witnesses. One of the things that just blows my mind, and this is why I'm not Emma, and Emma is that the plates were there, but she was told not to look at them. They were covered by a linen cloth, so very thinly covered, and she sometimes moved them when the cloth was over them. She never looked at them. But she was told by the Lord, that she was not to do that. But by inspiration, she was told, you know, it was made known to her that she was not to look at that. They also have one other woman that was a witness to them. That is, was it Polly Whitmer? I can't remember what her first name was. But I believe it was Polly Whitmer. When she was basically, she took on Joseph and his wife, and Oliver Cowdery was there, and all her own family. And she was overwhelmed with work and, I'm sure, exhaustion and so this is one of those tender mercies. As she was rounding the barn one day, there was an angel that showed her the plates. And then you have the testimony of these three witnesses and these eight witnesses. Now, you can read those in the Book of Mormon. Or if you want to, you can get that. And, you know, I'm not trying to plug a book, but it's a fascinating edition as a study guide for, you know, our study of the Book of Mormon. And the layout is significantly different. It's put in the poetic form when it warrants it. It's also put in paragraph form, which in many respects makes the Book of Mormon a little easier to read and to understand because paragraphs are basically groupings of ideas or thoughts. And so it helps us better sometimes intuit the meaning. But you can get that Maxwell edition. But in here they include the testimony of Emma Smith, and she was interviewed by Joseph Smith III. Obviously, this is we have the precursor to the Community of Christ, but the Restored Church of, what do they call it, the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So they go and they interview. Joseph Smith III goes to Nauvoo to interview Emma because she's a valuable witness to these things. And she's asked about this manuscript and, you know, had he not a book or manuscript from which Joseph read or dictated to you? He had neither manuscript nor book to read from. Could he have had any and you not know it? If he had anything of the kind, he could not have concealed it from me. Are you sure he had the plates at the time you were writing for him? And this is what she says. The plates, what I mentioned, often lay on the table without any attempt at concealment, wrapped in a small linen tablecloth, which I had given him. I once felt of the plates as they thus lay on the table, tracing their outline and shape. They seemed to be pliable, like thick paper, and would rustle with a metallic sound when the edges were moved by the thumb, as one does sometimes thumb the edge of a book. And where did they write? They wrote in the room where she was at work. This is when they were down in Pennsylvania. And could not Father have dictated the Book of Mormon to you, Oliver Cowdery, and the others who wrote for him, after having first written it or having first read it out of some book? And she says, now this is what's so interesting. Joseph Smith, this is the first time she uses her husband's name, could neither write nor dictate a coherent and well-worded letter, let alone dictating a book like the Book of Mormon. And though I was an active participant in the scenes that transpired and was present during the translation of the plates and had cognizance of things as they transpired, it is marvelous to me, a marvel and a wonder, as much so as to anyone else. And then she never attempted to handle the plates, and then she bears her witness that to the authenticity of them, and of course the fact that he, you know, would look into that, that would use that hat oftentimes, and that's sort of added in here, but he would use that hat to look into for the translation of the plates. So it's an extraordinary other witness besides those three witnesses. The other thing about the three witnesses is that it's significantly different, their experience with these documents. The three do not handle them. They don't see them. They see other things as well. They see the Sword of Laban. They see the Liahona. They see a number of other things as well. They hear the voice of the Lord. The voice of the Lord commands them to bear record of it. But then you have the eight witnesses. And they are not only shown the plates, but, and this is one of my favorite out of use words, but they have seen and hefted the plates. They lifted them. They looked at them. And these men were artisan and craftsmen, and so this was probably very intriguing to them. And you get various descriptions of their size and shape, probably about 6 by 9 inches, you know, and what those unsealed portions of the plate looked like. So they did a very close scrutiny, and they lifted, and they get a sense of their weight. And so their experiences and their testimony is significantly different, adding to our understanding of, you know, what these, you know, these documents were that were given to us. And then, of course, that they were given by inspiration. And so important that our Father in Heaven even speaks to those three witnesses. And remember, too, that, you know, with those three witnesses that you have, Martin Harris, who is not there for the initial showing of the plates. He has obviously not brought the right spirit to that when they go out to pray. And so he is off by himself. And the other two have the very same experience. Joseph then goes and finds Martin, who is off praying by himself. He and Joseph have that same experience again. And then, of course, that witness of those three individuals later followed by the eight witnesses.
Mike, thoughts?
What's fascinating to me is that the three witnesses, all of them, maintained their testimony throughout their entire lives, even though all three of them eventually had disagreements with Joseph Smith and left the church. And from, to my mind, their disaffection from Joseph and the church makes their testimonies all that much stronger. It would be much easier to criticize the witnesses if they had remained close friends of Joseph Smith at the end of his life. And instead, they became estranged from him, but adamantly held to their witness of what they saw on that summer day in 1829. In fact, David Whitmer had his testimony inscribed as his epitaph. It's on his tombstone, the record of the Nephites and so forth. It's all written on the side of his stone. And he was very bitter against Joseph and came to believe that everything that Joseph did after the Book of Mormon was incorrect. But as a testimony of the truthfulness of the Book of Mormon, that's about as strong as it gets from my mind. I wanted to take just a second, if I may, and address this, some of these criticisms of the witnesses, and because the witnesses are very strong. It's among the strongest, other than the spiritual witness that one can receive of the Book of Mormon, but the physical witness of the Book of Mormon. The witnesses are very, very strong. In fact, there's a wonderful book that was written in the early 1980s called Investigating the Book of Mormon Witnesses by Richard Lloyd Anderson, which is still in print. It's a little outdated, but I strongly recommend it to everyone. But one of the criticisms that we see that goes around today is that the witnesses really didn't see any of these things physically. They were all seen with a spiritual eye. This is a criticism that begins very, very early and is still being thrown around today, that they didn't really see what they said they saw, that this was all some kind of vision or a hallucination, that Joseph Smith would, you know, have these powers to hypnotize people or something like that. And the funny thing is that they responded to these in their own time. David Whitmer in 1887 responded to that charge, and here's a quote from him. He said, "Of course we were in the spirit when we had the view, for no man can behold the face of an angel except in a spiritual view. But we were in the body also, and everything was as natural to us as it is at any time." Martin Harris responded to this criticism, and he said, here's a quote from him, "Gentlemen, do you see my hand? Are you sure that you see it? Are your eyes playing a trick or something? No? Well, as sure as you see my hand, so sure did I see the angel and the plates." And there are many of these types of statements that they made. David Whitmer at another time struck the bed. I'm sorry, that was a different issue. He rose himself up to his full height, a little over 6 feet, and in very solemn and impressive tones he said, "I was not under any hallucination, nor was I deceived. I saw with these eyes, and I heard with these ears. I know whereof I speak." Very strong and powerful testimony. Oliver Cowdery, same thing. One of the last testimonies he gave was of that. But we've also recently discovered a very early testimony of his from November of 1829, before the Book of Mormon was even published. And this document written by Oliver Cowdery, he gives a description of this. So this is not something that was made up afterwards or anything like that. He wrote, "It was a clear, open, beautiful day, far from any inhabitants in a remote field, at the time we saw the record of which it has been spoken, brought and laid before us by an angel, arrayed in glorious light, who ascended," and he probably meant descended there, "out of the midst of heaven." Now, if this is human juggling, meaning sleight of hand or deception, if this is human juggling, judge ye. These are powerful testimonies by men who were clearly not deceived by anyone, let alone by Joseph Smith, who supposedly had powers of hallucination or something like that, or hypnotism. These were not perfect men by any means. They had struggles and challenges, and their relationships with Joseph Smith were all very, very difficult. But they testified, all of them testified very strongly and adamantly that they saw what they said they saw, that this was not something that was made up.
Mm-hmm. And while Oliver Cowdery and Martin Harris came back into the fold, so to speak, David Whitmer did not, but he lived a long, very successful life, widely respected in his community. And nearing the end of his life, there was a report, I don't know if it was in the newspaper, circulating that he had denied the Book of Mormon. And he took out an ad in the newspaper and basically deposed himself. But he testified again to the fact that he had seen them and that he had never reneged on his testimony of the Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
And with all the talk of you know, hallucination and mass hypnosis and so on and so forth, again, you have, by contrast, the testimony of the eight witnesses, which is just very matter-of-fact. And as was pointed out, these were men, these were grown men, they worked with their hands, they lived normal lives, and it is telling that the Lord had two very different types of witnesses that were made. Because however much you might dispute the testimony of the three witnesses, you still have the eight who said, yeah, we all held them. We held the plates, you know, passed them around. And it looks like we're coming up on a break. So we will be back after this break to finish up the Come Follow Me lesson. Welcome back to the Interpreter Radio Show. Mike Parker, Chris Fredrickson. I'm here, Bruce Webster, at the board, trying not to mess things up again. The Interpreter Radio Show is brought to you by Cruise Lady. Make your dream come true. Go on a cruise with a Latter-day Saint scholar. Experience an unforgettable, relaxing getaway on a cruise ship or an escorted land tour with Cruise Lady, perhaps the best in tours for Latter-day Saints. See Book of Mormon lands on a princess cruise through the Panama Canal with Martin Tanner as your guide. It leaves April 6, 2020. Fascinating ground tours and video presentations on fascinating topics at sea between ports. Or go on an incredible tour of the best of Russia and Scandinavia with Professor Daniel Peterson as your guide, leaving July 4, 2020. Or try an Alaskan cruise or an exotic Mediterranean cruise in August of 2020 with John Bytheway as your guide. For details, contact Cruise Lady at 801-453-9444 or on the web at cruiselady.com. Cruise Lady, perhaps the best in LDS cruises. Call 801-453-9444 or go on the web at cruiselady.com. Now, for the third segment here of the initial Book of Mormon Come Follow Me lesson, we're going to talk about the title page of the Book of Mormon, which is a fascinating document in and of itself. This was from the plates. This wasn't something Joseph Smith authored. This was directly on the plates. It was done, and probably one of the last things, if not the last thing, done by Moroni to label the entire record. And, of course, he names the entire book after his father, a tribute to him because of all the editorial work his father did in putting it together. We have in this a synopsis of the contents and the intent of the book. Brent Gardner has an excellent series of articles on the Interpreter Foundation website on the Book of Mormon and how it was written by both the portions done by Mormon and the portions done by Nephi and others on the small plates. And he notes that one of the important things that Mormon is doing is that he is writing something for us.
He did this abridgment not just as a chronicle to pass along. He did it knowing that this was, in fact, as Moroni will say here in the title page, to be hidden up and brought forth at the last days, to go forth both to the remnant of the seed of Lehi and to Jew and Gentile to convince them that Jesus is the Christ. So we've got, and I'm actually sitting here with that reading glasses looking at a blurry page in front of me. So I'm going to punt over to Mike for a minute and let Mike give some of his thoughts about the title page of the Book of Mormon and the structure of the Book of Mormon as a whole. Mike, what do you have thought?
Joseph Smith said in 1839 or dictated in 1839 that the title page of the Book of Mormon is a literal translation from the last leaf of the plates of Mormon. And it is therefore part of the scriptural text. It is not a modern invention, unlike, say, the introduction and the chapter headings, most of the chapter headings. There are some that are part of the text, the footnotes, the pronunciation guide, table of contents, and so forth. All of those things are modern additions. Joseph didn't mention who the author of the book was, but it's the title page itself indicates that it was sealed by the hand of Moroni, so it seems almost inescapable that it was Moroni, son of Mormon, the last survivor of the Nephite people. Because it was the last text written in the Book of Mormon, it's not a preface. It's actually a
postscript.
Postscript, there you go. Something interesting about this is that BYU professor the late Sidney B. Sperry, he theorized that Moroni wrote the title page in two different parts at two different times. His theory was that Moroni wrote his original farewell, which was the first paragraph of the title page, and that he did so after what we now have as Mormon chapter 8, verses 12 and 13, finding that there was still space on the plates and that he hadn't died, contrary to what he had expected. Moroni abridged the record of the Jaredites and added his own commentary, wrote his own book, and then wrote the second paragraph of the title page. Now, I don't know if Sidney B. Sperry was correct on that, but it is an interesting suggestion. It seems to kind of clear up some of those issues. But, you know, where did this come from, and how did it, how was it composed?
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit just to the structure of the Book of Mormon so we can understand a little better, and then to the title page as well. But I want to refer to what was mentioned a little bit earlier. Here's Mormon, and Mormon says this about the writing of the Book of Mormon. Now, when we think about Mormon, he was the editor. And what does an editor do? An editor works with the writers, or he picks and chooses what to include, or he recommends what to leave out for an author so that it's so that it's an accurate representation of what is intended. And what Mormon is doing here is he's doing what the Lord wants him to do. And the Lord, to help him understand what his duty and responsibility is, here's Moroni. He's speaking in Mormon 8:35. And he says, "Behold, I speak unto you as if ye were present, and yet ye are not. But behold," now he's talking about us, "but behold, Jesus Christ hath shown you unto me, and I know your doing." One of the things it says in the new manual for the Book of Mormon study this year is that we need to apply it to ourselves. And that's exactly what Mormon is doing when he edits this book, when he chooses what records he's going to include. Because he has seen us, and because he has seen the day and the times in which we live, he is including those portions of various texts that are pertinent for us today to help us better understand the deception, the lies, the mis and disinformation that we find in the world today, and also that we can very clearly understand the doctrine of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And in this sense, I think this is what Joseph Smith is referring to when he says this is the most correct book on earth. It's the most correct book of doctrine on the earth today. And then, of course, later we get the Doctrine and Covenants, which is sort of the, you know, the Book of Mormon, the keystone of our religion, where you have all of these doctrines mentioned, but where they are expanded upon, of course, we find that in the Doctrine and Covenants. And so here we have this book, and it's very carefully organized, and it's very carefully edited so that it is pertinent to us today. And I think that that's so important for us to understand. it does us no good to study history, to do anything, if we don't pick up that book and we say, what's the takeaway for me from what I'm reading here? And you will always, always find the takeaway. The other thing that's quite interesting is, with the loss of those 116 pages, that book of Lehi, I kind of think maybe this was the warm-up for Joseph Smith to get into the habit and to understand a little bit better about translating. But the Lord makes very clear that I'm going to give you something better. We're not going to have you retranslate that because wicked men have taken them. They're going to claim that you have done it wrong and that you're a false prophet. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you those small plates of Nephi. But when Joseph Smith picks up his... when he proceeds apace to translate the Book of Mormon, we're going to start with those large plates of Nephi. That's where he picks up again. So he's going to work, because the Book of Lehi is gone, so he works Mosiah through 4th Nephi, and then he works on the small plates, which are 1st Nephi through Omni, and then, of course, you have those plates of Ether. So that's very interesting to keep in mind as well. Now, with regards to this title page, the title page, you know, tells us the purpose of this text, how it's to be a testimony and a witness, and you know, and a witness of Jesus Christ, but what the purpose of this book is. I don't know, but I have this lovely quote by Ezra Taft Benson at the beginning of my scriptures. What's the major purpose of the Book of Mormon? To bring men to Christ and to be reconciled to him, and then to join his church in that order. That was Ezra Taft Benson conference report, October of 84. And, you know, we read again in the Book of Mormon that we will be condemned if we don't pay attention to this book, if we don't study it, if we don't love it, if we don't embrace it, if we don't try to understand these characters. I was just reading the other day, you know, you can always pull meaning from the scriptures. But I was reading in the book of, I was reading about Zizram. And here's Zizram. And I thought it was a misprint. I thought, I don't understand it, because he says, thine adversary has... Well, I can't remember, but he's saying, Zizram, your adversary has laid this plan, when it talks about this careful plan that Zizram had made to, you know, disabuse people of the truth. And so he says, thine adversary has, you know, in essence, this is thine adversary's plan. And I'm thinking, Zizram and Satan aren't adversaries, they're compatriots. But actually, Zizram is duped, isn't he? He's duped, and so he is a dupe that Satan is playing when he preaches false doctrine. But here we can find true doctrine of the gospel of Jesus Christ, which will serve us well now and throughout eternity. And then it says, you know, sealed by the hand of Mormon. It talks about what the purpose of this book is. But this purpose, of course, is an abridgment to show unto the remnant of the house of Israel what great things the Lord hath done for their fathers. Lots of history in this book. And that they may know the covenants of the Lord. Now, we're a covenant-keeping people. You don't find many people that talk covenants, many Christians that really talk covenants in the world today. There are some that do, but that certainly is intrinsic to us as members of the church. And to see that we are not cast off forever, and also to the convincing of the Jew and Gentile that Jesus is the Christ, the eternal God manifesting himself unto all nations. And if there are faults, it's the mistakes of men. So what an extraordinary title page that is, and what an extraordinary, you know, amount of education is bound up in just that short amount of text.
You know, for those of us who are old enough to remember when President Kimball was president of the church, when he became president, it was sort of unexpected. Everyone expected Harold B. Liddle to live for quite a long time, and he died very unexpectedly and relatively young. And they thought of President Kimball as a caretaker president, and he introduced all these major changes in the church. I mean, as I've said a number of times, President Nelson reminds me very much of President Kimball as far as just looking around saying, okay, what do we need to do to get the church moving forward? But President Kimball is incapacitated for the last few months of last few years of his life. And when he finally passed away and Ezra Taft Benson became president of the church, I thought, great, we can get back on track, and we can do this, and we can do that, and I'm sure there'll be some great announcements to be made. And President Benson got up and said, and Chris alluded to this quote, he said, we are under condemnation as a church because we have not been paying attention to the Book of Mormon. And I will honestly say my reaction at the time was like, wait, what? I've read it like, you know, 10 times. What's the big deal? You know, and I remember that sense of disappointment I had. And then not long after that, we happened to move from Utah to
Santa Cruz area, and I was called to help teach gospel doctrine, and of course the study was the Book of Mormon. And after about three or four Sundays of teaching the Book of Mormon and Doctrine and Covenants, and Gospel Doctrine class, I repented. Because I was digging into the Book of Mormon. I'd never taught the Book of Mormon. I'd never had a chance to teach it as a Sunday school teacher. And I was looking and thinking, oh my gosh, we so need this book. And it was sometime after that that I ran across my all-time favorite Hugh Nibley quote about the Book of Mormon, which is, "Woe unto the generation that understands the Book of Mormon." That was a discussion question he put in the 1957 Melchizedek Priesthood Study Guide, which you can buy as an approach to the Book of Mormon. And he got lots of letters saying, "Is that a typo? Didn't you mean woe unto the generation that doesn't understand the Book of Mormon?" And his response was, "No, we know how things end in the Book of Mormon." When you look around and you see what's going on, you have cause to worry. That's the end of our roundtable for tonight. We'll be back over the top of the hour for our second hour of the Interpreter Radio Show. Thank you very much.